Drive Time on BCFM. 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. More daylight robbery as rail fares go up again, way above inflation. Well, we called First Great Western yesterday, invited them on to explain, but they didn't reply. It took 12 years or so for the accusations of who was to blame for the Paris Concorde crash to work their way through the French courts. And when they finally did last month, there were some surprising revelations. So I talked to a former private pilot and a barrister who's been chatting to ex-Concorde pilots about what really happened. What was to blame? Who was to blame, indeed, for the crash that killed 113 people, and why there was no justification in it for ending Concorde's career back in 2003? And up close and personal on the Falklands conflict, is it just a load of hot air and electioneering by the Argentinian president, Christine Kirchner, or are old wounds from World War II reopening again in the form of controlling global oil supplies? And as ever, Martin Summers will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But after, we have a chat to BCFM's very own Steve Satan and his his double role, really, as a spokesperson for Rail Future. Hi, Steve.
Hello, how you doing?
Now, I've heard you on 5 Live as I'm driving around in the car when I'm not listening to BCFM, which, of course, is extremely rare. Talking about this quite a lot over the last few days. In fact, there's a sort of two waves of this story have hit. First of all, 10% increases when wages are actually being depressed. This is absolutely crippling. How on earth can it make sense to put rail fares up 10%?
Well, it doesn't. That's the simple answer. I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned I've been on the radio and the TV a lot. This happens every year. The rail fares go up, and this is the 10th year in a row that they've been 1% above inflation. And I'm getting a sense that this year, for some reason, it's really hit a nerve, and there's real sort of public anger on this, whereas perhaps in previous years, they've sort of taken it on the chin and thought, here we go again. 10 years on the road. So if you look at the statistics, some of which I've just invented, you can find them on the web. It's the 10th year in a row that the rail fares have gone up. So if you compound the fare increases, that's a 50% increase in the last 10 years.
Now, surely the whole point of privatising rail back in the early 1990s was simply to cut rail fares. Because we were being told that the whole point of it was that rail fares were going to come down.
Well, they may have said that. I mean, obviously, the Tory government who privatised the railways believed in this sort of free market mantra of competition, bringing down costs, greater efficiency, all that nonsense, you know. And it is nonsense in the case of railways, certainly, because what's happened is the complexity of the privatised railway is such that there are so many different companies, so many different organisations, all doing contracts with each other, all having lawyers and accountants to act between them, and that complexity has hugely added costs to the railway. So our costs are about 40% higher than our European counterparts.
Oh, that's 40% higher. That's a whacking amount. Mm. But surely, I mean, most of this money is going, you're saying, on administration, but it must also, quite a lot must be going to the shareholders of the various businesses involved.
Well, I think the train operating companies themselves are actually running a fairly tight ship. They're not raking it in.
So who is?
Well, there was a contract. Well, obviously, the accountants and lawyers in between, this sort of inefficiency. And actually, the government are raking it in. The government, they may protest that they're investing or subsidising the railways to the tune of, you know, billions of pounds every year. But poor old Network Rail, for instance, have to pay £1.5 billion interest every year on the loans that they're forced to take out from the commercial banks in order to pay for the infrastructure investment. And not on top of that, they have to pay the government £200 million a year to guarantee those loans. Now, this is where it's really, you know, unfair, because when you compare that to the roads, of course, the roads budget, they just get a grant from the DfT. The rail, they have to borrow it on commercial rates, and that's much more expensive.
Now, the weird thing, of course, is that some of the same banks that they're having to pay that back to may be the banks that actually own the rolling stock.
They may indeed. So this is one of the many, many ways ways in which the government claws back money out of the railways. So there's things like rail fuel duty. I bet you didn't know that existed, did you? But the, you know, First Great Western have to pay tax on the fuel that they use to run the trains in providing this public service. And there's no reason why they should have to pay that. The airlines don't pay fuel tax.
Well, that's because it's an international service, isn't it?
Well, domestic airlines don't have to pay fuel tax. But, you know, it's about a level playing field, and there simply isn't one.
Okay, so is this going to mean simply that more people get driven into cars because the price of fuel is going up? I mean, even without the government allowing the fuel duty to go up, the price of is still creeping up and creeping
up. It is. Although I think there have been one or two slight reductions in
well, hang on a minute. Just a minute.
Hang on.
Because the fuel goes up, and it goes up, and then it goes down a little bit.
Well, yeah? Okay, but it does go down a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, generally speaking, over the long term, fuel's gone up. But, again, you know, the government can afford to not, you know, to freeze petrol duty. Why can't they afford to freeze rail tickets? That would be perfectly fair and reasonable, wouldn't it? So that you're absolutely right. When it comes to alternatives, for many commuters, there isn't one. You know, particularly if you're going into central London, you know, imagine parking in central London and driving in through the rush hour, or even through Bath or Bristol, it's still pretty bad, you know. So these alternatives aren't there. The other thing that they're trying to do, or they're talking about doing, is to... it's called demand management, where you make the most popular fares even more expensive and the cheaper fares even cheaper in the hope of persuading people not to travel at rush hour. But of course, you know, people don't have a choice. They have to get into the office for 9 o'clock, and that means taking a rush hour train.
That's awful. I mean, surely, I mean, what they're saying is if you've got no choice about when you travel, we're going to actually jack up the fares even more. I think this is part of that McNulty report, which came out about 8 months ago. They were saying that what we need to do is actually deregulate the entire thing so that train companies can charge where people are forced to take a particular journey and they don't have any choice over that particular journey, then they're going to be starting to pay, you know, maybe even double what they're paying now.
Well, yeah, this is one of the things that McNulty is advocating, this demand management, or greater demand management. And there's a report came out today from the Transport Select Committee basically saying, you know, that's not on. It's not sustainable, it's not fair on commuters, and that the era of ever-increasing rail ticket prices can't go on.
Okay, but does this Commons Committee actually have any clout?
I think they do have a bit of clout. I mean, inevitably it's adding to the noise, the public rumour of discontent. So if the politicians are saying it, and groups such as us are saying it, and Joe Public is saying it, then I think the government, they sort of had to listen, and I'm hoping that the government will wake up to the fact that commuters actually have votes as well.
Right, well, I suppose that's their secret weapon. I noticed there were protests as well at some of the stations around here about these rail fare increases. Mm. What's been going on, though, with the West Coast Main Line? Because that was a fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes shenanigans that goes on when these contracts are awarded, these franchises are awarded. A little bit of scrutiny was done on it at the behest of Richard Branson and Virgin Trains, and it was discovered that actually that franchise hadn't been fairly awarded. We're trusting, aren't we, the Department for Transport and these train companies to play by the rules, and it seems like certainly First Group are simply not doing that.
Well, I don't know whether the First Group were playing by the rules, but the Department for Transport certainly won't. I mean, it really was one of these spectacular cock-ups. It was a fiasco. It wasn't like a minor error. It was like they were just inventing numbers, really, and they got found out. But it shows really that there's a huge sort of a lack of direction, a lack of ownership, a lack of, you know, giving a care about the railways in the part of government. You look at how long your average transport secretary is in the job. It's not very long. They're definitely pretty low down on the pecking order, and it shows.
Martin, your thoughts about this, because we're in a bit of a... I mean, obviously, transport is an absolutely key part of what we're doing as... a city. I mean, we've got all sorts of problems with commuting into and out of Bristol. Thankfully, not quite. That will kick in next week again, of course, when the kids go back to school. Is there any kind of solution to this kind of thing? Because we can see, I mean, particularly what Steve was talking about there from Rail Future about the Network Rail's massive debt it's having to service is killing off any possibility that we pay for what we get with railways.
Well, and the subsidies given to the railways by government are, I believe, about 300% higher than they were under nationalisation. And in actual fact, you see, what we're doing in this country, nobody in the world tries to run public transport at a profit. But we do. We pretend we do, but of course we don't. What we're actually doing is profiteering off the infrastructure. And the infrastructure, like railways, is something that you should run at a loss to make your export businesses more competitive, so that people can... And also, of course, this rail increase in fares will actually hit people's pay packets, which again will then affect the economy and all the rest of it. There's no plan, is there? That's the problem.
It's the free market. No plan. It's the free market. Anyway,
they make a virtue of not having a plan, but of course, it's stupid. You have to have a plan.
Your group's called Rail Future.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the future as you see it? What would you like to see happen? If you were sitting in the Transport Secretary's shoes, what would you do to change things?
What would I do? I'd certainly allow the West Coast to continue, the East Coast franchise to continue as a state-owned, not-for-profit franchise.
Is that the only one in the country that actually is a not-for-profit?
I believe there's one other. I can't remember what it is.
It was cancelled. Somehow there was a problem with the East Coast mainline franchise. The company either folded or decided it didn't want to do it anymore. And so the old British Rail, if you want, stepped in to do that as a government-run thing. How is it actually working?
Well, it seems to be working very well, actually. Time will tell. I mean, it's still relatively early days. It's only a couple of years ago, I think. But you know, if you are genuinely interested in providing the best service for the public, then you would compare two models, wouldn't you? Rather than being driven by ideology and say it must be privatised. But these other things I was talking about the level playing field. I would abolish rail fuel duty. I would allow the railway to be funded on grants in the same way that the roads are. I'd work towards taxing fuel for environmental reasons. And to be fair to the government, there are some moves which are very good. The electrification of the Great Western, which is coming up in the next few years, is very welcome and very long overdue. But we've got a lot of catching up to do on investment on the railways. And if I was in charge, we'd have high-speed rail, but we wouldn't have the route they've chosen for HS2, because that's flawed.
Why?
It's a long story. How long have you got?
Why is it going the wrong way?
Okay, the reason it's going the wrong way, it's very poor connections at both ends. It doesn't go into Birmingham New Street. The whole of the network isn't planned, so they've just done it. Well, we'll go to London to Birmingham and then see what we do next. It's not a very good way of planning a network. They've arbitrarily chosen a super high speed, and the super high speed means you have to have super straight track, which means you have to go through the Chilterns. They've decided that they need to serve Heathrow, even though very, very few passengers will serve Heathrow. There's an interchange at Aldwych Common that isn't necessary. It goes on and on. But you know that we need to learn the lessons from how the French have got and other countries have got high speed rail right and where they've got it wrong.
Yeah, it seems that you know the country that invented the railway has made an absolute dog's breakfast of it.
I think there's an awful lot of truth
in
that. It's ironic.
How's that happened?
Well, it's ideology, really. I mean, the privatisation of the railways was the final act of vandalism of the major government. And, of course, what's happened, we then had 13 years of Labour government. They said, well, we can't do anything about this because we haven't got any resources, we've got no money, and, of course, we would like to renationalise maybe, but we can't do it. Oh, the banks are crumbling. Oh, we've got loads of money for the banks. Oh, yes, oh, and money's no object. But the railways, oh, no, well, and that's the failure. So the Thatcher era and the Major era started the dog's breakfast, and then you had 13 years of Labour government, and they just didn't do anything. They just sat on their hands. And that's why we're in such a mess.
And John Prescott promised us, didn't he? He said, we'll have a nationally state-owned, publicly accountable railway, and he didn't deliver.
No. And okay. Of course, it's just we're still limping along with this structure. And, as you know, we're a laughing rolling stock, aren't we?
Your other programme that you do on BCFM, Steve, when's that on? People want to hear a bit of your musical taste as well as your railway.
Well, if you want to hear me not talking about the railways, I'm on BCFM on Monday lunchtime from 12 till 2 and Wednesday lunchtime from 12 till 2.
That's Steve Satan from BCFM and also from Rail Future. Thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Martin, we've got some changes, haven't we, over in Bolivia that happened over the Christmas break. Bolivia has nationalised two Spanish-owned electrical utilities. I mean, we were talking about railways just now. Morales, Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, has decided he's taking these electrical companies off of the Spanish owners, the present Spanish owners.
Yeah, in Latin America, you've got these left-wing governments that have come to power in the last decade, and they are actually renationalising industries which were privatised. Because, of course, it's like a game of football. You can nationalise industries, and in fact, in many countries, it's a perfectly rational step.
I mean, the argument we constantly hear is that there isn't enough money for the state to buy it up.
Well, I mean, basically, the point is that you then get the revenue stream from the companies. And don't forget that, you know, things like energy are strategic for a country. You know, it's not, it's, you can't have a plan unless you've got some control over your energy resources. And, you know, this is, you know, basically the case for utilities being in the public sector is frankly overwhelming. It always was. And the idea that privatisation is the only answer to everything, well, that's just a lot of nonsense.
So is it going to happen?
Well, what it, the Bolivians are doing this, aren't they? They are nationalising these utilities.
The other thing, of course, is that news from that part of the world is Hugo Chavez is not doing very well after his operation for cancer. He's the socialist president of Venezuela.
He's indicated that Nicolas Maduro is his chosen successor, and it may be that there will be an election in Venezuela before the end of January if Chavez doesn't make it, but I think his movement is now strong enough to function without him.
He was intimating that rather too many leaders in Latin America and other parts of the world had been catching cancer recently, almost as if potentially he'd been poisoned.
Well, let's not. He's obviously raising a question about that, but there's no doubt whatsoever that the US backed a coup against Chavez, the elected leader, and the coup plotters killed quite a lot of people while they had 24 hours of power. It's not surprising that people get fed up with the United States of America, is it?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, as well as his court work, Michael Shrimpton QC is an intelligence consultant. When I spoke to him earlier this week, he explained how the police were being used in an attempt to suppress his forthcoming book, Spy Hunter. So we get a sneak preview of that presently banned book here, which is planned to be released in the United States later in the year. Michael Shrimpton also has rather a lot to say about past and present debacles with Argentina over the Falkland Islands, a dispute which may simply come down to a fight for the oil deposits that lay off the islands. The Argentinians also know that with Britain's reduced armed forces, we would be likely be in no position to defend those islands militarily.
I'm Michael Shrimpton. My day job is barrister. I used to be an immigration judge many years ago. My other job is as an intelligence and national security consultant. I've just written my first major book, Spy Hunter. We weren't getting anywhere in the intelligence community. We were being blocked persistently and consistently in London and Washington, and it seemed to me that only by bringing public pressure to bear on politicians could you actually get anywhere. It's extraordinarily frustrating. Intelligence is about speaking truth to power, but if there's nobody in power able to act on the intelligence, then it's a little bit pointless gathering it in the first place.
Now, you've had a few problems with the book, haven't you? I mean, this is often happens with things like Spycatcher, for example, back in the 1980s, and Peter Wright, he also had difficulty actually getting it published and getting it out there.
Well, correct. In fact, the very flat in which we are speaking was raided by Thames Valley Police, and they seized the entire book, along with my working notes and every backup copy that I had. Had I not taken the precaution of backing it up offshore, we wouldn't be publishing at all. Thames Valley still haven't given the book back. It's been reviewed in a desperate effort to try and find some mechanism for suppressing publication. There's nothing illegal about telling the truth, and there's nothing illegal about writing a book. Obviously, I haven't libeled anybody, and there's no breach of the Official Secrets Act.
It does paint rather a sorry picture of Britain today, where the most interesting radical books, it's very difficult to actually get them published here in Britain.
No, there'd be absolutely no question of publishing in Britain. Any publisher of any size would come under very heavy pressure not to publish. For example, from the Cabinet Office, because I've identified the first five Cabinet Secretaries after the very first Cabinet Secretary, Lord Hankey, known in the intelligence community as Hankey Panky. I've identified the first five Cabinet Secretaries as German spies. I'm well aware the Cabinet Office are desperate to suppress publication. So the seizure of the book was sanctioned by the Cabinet Office.
Can you just give us any insight into what may have actually been behind the Falklands crisis in the first place and how that's likely to play out in the years to come? Because, of course, this is a British protectorate territory which is miles, really, thousands and thousands of miles away from our home shores, and Britain's power is waning.
Well, our power is waning because we're in the European Union. We have a very silly government, and no offence intended, a very silly Prime Minister. We in the Tory Party obviously need to address that issue by getting rid of David Cameron, which I'm confident will happen in the spring, and putting a sensible Tory in place who can go to the country with a sensible Conservative platform. But you're right about Argentina. The German connection to Argentina is deep. Perón was a pro-German fascist. His wife, after his death, his wife took over, so you had pro-German dictators of Argentina for most of the post-war period. The Germans moved a great deal of gold. They had a fleet of, and I address this in Spy Hunter, they had a fleet of Type 21 submarines. Now, the Type 21 was thought by people in naval intelligence at the time to be a threat directed at our transatlantic convoys. It never was. Most of the Type 21s were used for transport. They had at least a 50-ton carrying capacity, carried very few torpedoes, and were designed for the shipment of people and gold and intellectual property and records and so on out of Germany. If you wanted to get out of Germany in 44-45, you needed to book yourself a berth on a Type 21 U-boat. They had great range, considerable capacity, they had a very large hull, and these boats were going mostly down to Argentina, although there were some drop-off points in the Antarctic, and some of them were going round to Japan, and there were various transshipment points in the Kerguelen, the Crozier Islands, there were a whole bunch of transshipment points that we now know about but didn't at the time. The Type 21s were taking people like Martin Bormann, Adolf Eichmann, down to Argentina. And
well, hang on a second, because Bormann is supposed to have died in Berlin. He was Hitler's assistant after Rudolf Hess's unsuccessful mission to try and persuade the British to make an alliance with Hitler. Bormann was Hitler's deputy, and he died in Berlin.
No. That may be the official version of events. Hess, of course, was not a Nazi. Hess worked for Admiral Canaris. Hess was an asset of German intelligence. And when he flew to Britain in 1941, he was working with a German spy called Sir Edward Bridges, who was then the cabinet secretary. And Bridges and Hess, between them, were intending to install Lord Halifax. That coup was spotted by British intelligence. Churchill was briefed in, and we headed them off at the pass. The Hess flight to Britain was all to do with a coup, with a view to replacing Churchill, bringing in the pro-German Halifax, who was called his peerage, the Wood family peerage was originally purchased from Lloyd George. They weren't proper peers. Halifax wanted to take Britain out of the war. Halifax was keen to support the planned German invasion of the Soviet Union, although in fact Canaris had no intention of carrying that out. Halifax wanted Hitler replaced as head of Germany and wanted to see himself as Prime Minister of Britain. Canaris was hoping to offload Hitler. It was a very complex operation directed against Hitler in Germany, Churchill in Britain, with the idea of ensuring complete German domination of the British Empire, ultimately Russia, through Canaris's asset Stalin, and eventually the United States. It was a very, very dangerous moment in world history. The sinking of HMS Hood was critical to the plan, because the intent was to embarrass Churchill and undermine him through the sinking of the Hood. We now think that the Hood was probably sunk by an IED planted in the X-turret 15-inch magazine, detonated by radio from Bismarck. And I addressed this issue in Spy Hunter, which is why, of course, nobody can explain ballistically how Bismarck could possibly have sunk Hood in the short time that she did. Some of your listeners may have bought into the weak deck theory, but I can assure you HMS Hood's deck armour was almost as strong as Bismarck's. Hood had been substantially strengthened and redesigned after the Battle of Jutland. She was a very powerful warship. The 1941 coup failed. Argentina was a German client state for most of the post-war period. Galtieri was very close to the Germans and effectively was installed by the Germans. The German DVD station in Buenos Aires was very powerful. The Israelis had come across it because a very great Israeli intelligence officer called Rafi Eitan, who's still alive, had worked out that Eichmann was down in Buenos Aires, understood that the Germans had carried on with their intelligence after 1945, and the kidnap of Adolf Eichmann was not so much to do with revenge for the Holocaust, but the acquisition by Israel of strategic intelligence on what the Germans were up to. And the critical interview of Eichmann. Eichmann was always told by his own side, standard for the Germans, he was given all sorts of bogus assurances by the Germans that they would look after him and he wouldn't hang. And the night before he was executed, Eichmann realized that all the assurances he'd been given by his own people were rubbish, that he was going to be sacrificed. Germans always sacrifice their own people. And Rafi went along to see him with a bottle of scotch, because Adolf was quite partial to the scotch. He preferred scotch to schnapps. And Rafi and Adolf had a good conversation. And this is quite good to get a deathbed confession. It was very smart intelligence work by Rafi. it's the notes of those meetings that really form the basis of modern Israeli understanding of the German DVD. And Rafi, I'm not sure he would tell you very much, but the old boy happily is still with us.
You mentioned the DVD there. This is some sort of organisation you say exists, but there's very, very little evidence for it, Michael.
Well, it's a black intelligence organisation, so by definition, black intelligence organisations don't go around publishing their accounts. I mean, you could probably say that in the old days there was very little evidence for the existence of MI5 or MI6. Their existence certainly wasn't officially acknowledged. But the fact that it wasn't officially acknowledged didn't mean it didn't exist. The DVD do exist. The only other person apart from me to have gone public on their existence was a man called Christopher Story, a very nice man, a friend of mine, who was murdered by the DVD in 2010, poisoned. He announced on his own website the night before he died that he'd been poisoned. The Jerrys gave him liver cancer, which is very nasty, not very nice of them. Christopher's murder, incidentally, was unusually set up by a British police force, Thames Valley Police, because the Germans have an operation in London called GO2. They have penetrated Thames Valley Police, and Christopher was visited by two GO2 assets inside Thames Valley Special Branch at Kidlington, who rubbished me to Christopher. I'm quite sure they didn't know at the time that they were part of a plot to have Christopher assassinated. Christopher had gone public on the DVD. He'd outed Edward Heath as a German spy in 2005. He was very much on the DVD hit list, as indeed am I. And typically, the Germans will make use of assets in local police forces. They're useful idiots. How much these idiots knew what they were doing, I don't know. I suspect not very much. But they helped get Christopher murdered by driving a wedge between me and him. I wasn't able to warn him about this German spy that he was meeting with in Erie, Pennsylvania. Christopher goes out to Erie, is poisoned by this man, and dies a rather unhappy death, a rather painful death, the following, a few months later. Very sad.
Evidence, then, of the existence of this DVD organisation?
Well, I'm not going to blame my sources. The only senior DVD officer that I've named in Spy Hunter, with whom I had a discussion about the DVD, who's now dead, was General Oberst Marcus Wolf. Now, Marcus Wolf is a very powerful source. You understand, in the world of intelligence, we don't go around blowing our sources. It's a good way of getting people killed. I've explained at length in the preface to Spy Hunter, I am not identifying sources. I don't want anybody to die as a result of my book. Where a source has died, then I'm certainly able to name him, providing I'm not putting his family at risk. General Oberst Marcus Wolf was one of my sources on the DVD. Now, he wasn't a willing source, he was a DVD officer. But he knew I knew about the DVD, I knew he knew I knew, and Marcus and I had a cordial acquaintanceship. We actually got on quite well, like the old boy. I'm quite happy to buy him a drink. In fact, it was a good way of getting intelligence out of somebody, buy them a drink and get them talking. I wasn't in any way hostile to him, although he was the enemy. He was a charming man. Didn't deny the existence of the DVD in circumstances where you would rather expect a denial. It stands for Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst, or German Defence Service, although the V has also stood for Versicherungs, the German Insurance Service. The DVD with Versicherung, V standing for Versicherungs, or insurance, was used as a commercial cover. I think that was used in, I think they had an office in Bangkok during the Vietnam War. They have used Deutsche Versicherungsdienst, but the DVD officially stands for Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst, or German Defense Service. It was set up by Admiral Canaris when he realized Germany was losing World War II. He moved all the major files, all the key people were moved out of the Abwehr headquarters in Berlin, down to new headquarters in Dachau. The headquarters in Dachau put under the operation, put under the directorship of Generalleutnant Erwin von Lahusen. Lahusen cut a deal with the Americans and was a witness for the Allies in the Nuremberg war trials, where one of the prosecutors was a friend of mine, now sadly no longer with us, Lord Elwin Jones, junior counsel to David Maxwell Fife. In 43, von Lahusen drops out of sight. And this is where we see the creation of the DVD. It became fully operational in 1945. Canaris had cut a deal with Himmler, reneged on it. Himmler agreed to fake Canaris' execution. Canaris went out of Berlin down into Spain. He was operating out of Madrid for a while. There was a front organization there called the German Geopolitical Center. Another front organization supported SS veterans, the Odessa organization. Freddie Forsyth, who I know, nice chap. Freddie came across the Odessa organization some years ago, and what he says in his famous novel about Odessa, there was such an organization of SS veterans. So the novel's a great novel, as you would expect from Freddie, but it was also based on fact. And Odessa, the German Geopolitical Center, were only two of a number of fronts. The Bilderberg Group was another, set up in 1954, and the Trilateral Commission was another. The front organizations, their existence is pretty much taken as read. I mean, there's no dispute about the existence of the Bilderberg Group or the Trilateral Commission or the German Geopolitical Center, or much dispute about the Odessa organization. The DVD, yes, there is a dispute officially. In the intelligence community, at a senior level, knowledge of the DVD marks you out as a senior player. And I've had conversations with senior intelligence officers about the DVD, who are perfectly aware of it. Officially, they will deny it, but privately, they won't. I've even had conversations about the DVD with senior German intelligence officials. For example, a senior intelligence official in the intelligence liaison section of the Chancellor's office in Berlin. There is discussion about the DVD on the internet, but most of it will be a throwback to work that I've done or Christopher. So you will find some websites on the internet prepared to talk about it, but they're reliant on work done by myself and Christopher. In terms of going public, only two people so far have gone public on the DVD, myself and Christopher Story. And so one of us has paid for their courage, sadly, with their life. I'm still going strong. Well, I can assure you, should the DVD catch up with me, everything I know about them will emerge into the public domain. It's one of the reasons why I'm still alive. I have rather good life insurance.
Well, Michael Shrimpton, QC there. Martin, I suppose the most disturbing thing about Michael's sort of giving us a bit of a tour around his book, Spy Hunter, which is in the hands of Thames Valley Police at the moment. He's getting it published, he believes, around about Easter time in the United States, because he quite smartly kept copies of it abroad and still had copies, even though his flat had been raided with all the research and various manuscripts of his book taken away. Spy Hunter sounds like it would be quite an interesting book, but what do you make of this idea that you know, maybe this is rubbish, and you know, there's some nonsense in there, and that essentially that the police may be trying to stop, you know, criminal possible official secrets coming out, this kind of thing?
Well, it's all fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I can't wait to get a hold of the copy of the book and have a look at whether the allegations stand up.
But I mean, isn't that what happens in modern Britain? You write a book and the police come and raid your house and take it away?
Well, obviously it does. And but of course, BCFM is there to make sure that the public are informed.
Well, what do you make of his claims? I mean, for example, he's talking about there some pretty outlandish claims. One which was that five cabinet secretaries were actually not loyal to Britain, but they were working for German intelligence service.
Well, I mean, that's the sort of thing that has to be investigated and stood up if you're going to write a book about it. It's an allegation. The question is, what's the evidence? But I think the idea that Bormann and others escaped to Argentina, I think that's pretty well established in Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And of course, when we're talking about the Germans, we're not talking about the current German government. Basically the National Socialists regrouped in Latin America with the help of British and US intelligence, of course. I mean, the head of the West German intelligence service in the post-war period was formerly the head of the Gestapo. Operation Paperclip helped lots of ex-Nazis to escape justice in the 1940s, and people like Klaus Barbie ended up being put in to train the Bolivians. We were talking about Bolivia earlier, nationalising their electricity industry, but the Bolivian army's torturers were trained by Klaus Barbie, brokered by the CIA. And basically, you know, these kind of right-wing German, British, American, and Israelis, of course. The Israelis have been bought into this because the Bormann organisation basically paid off the Israelis, and a lot of the German companies that they set up had Jewish people on the boards, because basically gangsters are gangsters.
Well, he's talking about a lot of the German resources looted from Europe during World War II being taken across in these particular type of submarine, I think he called it a Type 21 U-boat, at the end of the Second World War to Argentina. So do you think that maybe this conflict with the Falklands might start to reopen some of these old sores from World War II? And also, do you think Britain is, could project any kind of military power to the Falklands to defend it? Like, I mean, even if Cameron wanted to, could he do what Thatcher did in the 80s?
Before Galtieri invaded the Falklands, Britain and the US were very, very friendly with the Argentinian junta, even though they murdered 30,000 of their own people under the most horrible circumstances. They just stepped out of line from the point of view of the international power structure. And incidentally, on the Falklands, surely it would be quite straightforward for Britain to say, no, these islands are going to remain part of Britain because that's what people want, although goodness knows the Chagos Islanders and Diego Garcia don't get treated like that. But the oil, surely the Argentinians have a right to the oil. We're not interested. We're only interested in the people. We're not colonialists. So we'll have the islands and the Argentinians can have the oil.
But the oil is worth trillions, isn't it?
Yes, and of course the Argentinians have got a large population. Many of people live in poverty and they're struggling to try and develop their country. Why shouldn't they have the oil?
So how do you think this is going to play out? I mean, in March, we've got a referendum taking place of the Falkland Islanders to decide whether they want to remain a British colony.
Well, if I was in charge of the British policy, I'd say, well, look, the Falkland Islanders don't want to be part of Argentina, fair enough, but you can have the oil.
What about this concept of projecting any power if the Argentinians were to actually threaten to or actually invade the Falkland Islands?
Well, a lot of people in Latin America, all the other governments in Latin America are supporting the Argentinian position. And all the Argentinians are saying is negotiate about this, which seems fair enough, I mean, you've got to negotiate with people even if you're not going to agree with them. And actually, what this is about the natural resources of the South Atlantic. And the Argentinians quite rightly say, look, this is our continental shelf. We've got a population of millions of people here. We can't have all of our development stopped because there's 1,000 people living on a rock in the middle of the ocean saying that all of the oil surrounding them belongs to them, and that's not on. I mean, if they want to carry on herding sheep and all the things that they do in the Falkland Islands, they can carry on, but the oil, quite logically enough, should go to the Argentinians. And of course that's a done deal then, isn't it? That's the sort of thing I would be saying if I was British Prime Minister negotiating about it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, late last year, Continental Airlines were cleared of causing the disastrous 2000 Concorde crash in Paris. But as so often in these cases, the initial lies go 10 times around the world and the final truth hardly gets a mention. What it tells is a sorry, if even despicable, tale of a great Bristol success story sold down the river, accompanied by a pack of lies, a real insult to previous generations of Bristolian engineers. And we go back to here Michael Shrimpton, former pilot and also hobnobber with Concorde pilots again.
People of Bristol can rightly take pride. Remember, the Concorde was a Bristol aircraft. If you look at the French proposals for a supersonic airliner, they were rubbish. They were far too small, and they didn't have the Ogilvie wing, which was essentially a contribution made by the Bristol Aeroplane Company. Sadly, it became British Aircraft Corporation. Concorde should always be regarded as a product of the old Bristol Company. She was the last great aircraft produced by a wonderful company. Ideally, I'd like to bring that company back. And ideally, I'd like to, instead of Concorde's rust away, I'd like to refurbish them, put them in a hangar at Filton, have them completely refurbished, top to bottom, zero-hour, and brought back into service as VIP aircraft. British Airways won't have them, but I'd give one to the Queen, put one into the Queen's flight, for example, and have another one. The Prime Minister could, instead of flying to America on some boring old subsonic aeroplane he's rented from British Airways, he could turn up on a proper Royal Air Force Concorde, we could call it the Concorde C-Mark 1, probably keep them at Northolt position down to Heathrow for a full load takeoff. The PM could turn up in a proper British bit of kit. Now, I have commented on the Concorde crash in Spy Hunter, and I suspect, I may be blowing my own trumpet, but since nobody else is around to blow it, I'll have to blow my own, won't I? I suspect the French have altered their position in the light of Spy Hunter. Spy Hunter has been circulating the intelligence community for about a year. We've had to completely rewrite it in American. It was written in English, and I'm having to translate into American. Obviously, American, technically American English, since it's being published in Boston, the United States. Also, the publishers wanted it written in the first person rather than the third, being a very modest sort of chap. I'd written it in the third person. That, if you think about it, that's the entire book. You know, every S has to be turned into a Z, as the Americans call it, and the author said this has to become the I said. Effectively, the whole book has been rewritten, and my cunning plan was to write the book, go back to the bar. Unfortunately, I had to go back to the bar partly to earn a living, and I'd taken 18 months off to write the book, had written it, went back to the bar, and of course, the solicitors send you work. I'm not complaining. If you're a solicitor and you wish to send me work, please don't feel discouraged. It is my day job. For about 2 or 3 months, I've hardly worked on the book at all. So it has been a bit difficult, but it's taken nearly a year to do the rewriting and the editing, and it didn't help having the Rosses, no offence intended, make off with the book and all my working notes, which caused a delay of 2 or 3 months. Not very helpful. So for one reason or another, the book has been delayed, but it's been circulating in the intelligence community. It was written by March. Spy Hunter in draft form has been circulating in the intelligence community for about a year. I was able to keep it off the internet, an email, whilst I wrote it, but from the time it went to the first publisher, once it's been emailed to peer reviewers and editors and what have you, there's no way of keeping it quiet. And the intelligence community have had the book, and the French have known about my opinions on Concord for about a year, and the point I'm making at great length is that the French have modified their position on Concord. In Spy Hunter, I reveal for, I think, the first time that the French claim that the Concorde crash was caused by a piece of titanium engine cowl off a DC-10 engine, the CF-6 General Electric engine cowl, off a Continental Airlines DC-10 that was flying out of Paris to Houston, is absolute nonsense, because the DC-10 was inspected when she arrived at Houston. She was inspected, and there was no missing engine cowl.
So this is the idea being that something dropped off of this aircraft ahead of the Concorde, and that the Concorde crashed into some debris from this other aircraft on the runway, and that's what caused the crash.
Yeah, it's all a French farce. There was no missing bit off the Continental DC-10. I've no doubt the French certainly claimed to have found a piece of titanium engine cowl on the runway. That piece of cowling almost certainly came off a UAT DC-10, was the French also had DC-10s. They no doubt went and raided the nearest DC-10, which was French, borrowed some bits from it, and distributed them over the runway for somebody to find. A crash was clearly not caused by the titanium engine cowl. In any event, the people involved in putting bits out of the runway are sort of low down the intelligence food chain, and whichever doofus they got to do it didn't realise that the Concorde tyres had burst further down the runway. So he put it on the wrong part of the runway anyway, something that Continental Airlines French lawyer pointed out gleefully in the French inquiry last year. What happened was the French either deliberately left out or mistakenly left out a port spacer on the port undercarriage bogey. This is a wheel spacer, which basically kept the wheels at the right distance. And without that spacer, which is the bit that goes on the axle between the two wheels, without that spacer, the wheels were free to track. And the result of that was that Concorde veered to port in her takeoff run, which in any event was downwind and overweight, something that commentators generally fail to point out. The French were trying to take off in the wrong direction, and the aircraft was overweight, which is about 6,000 pounds overweight. Utter nonsense. What happened was the aircraft, unsurprisingly, tracked the port left-hand side of the runway, collided with runway lights, and it was the debris from the runway lights that went up into the port undercarriage bay, which allowed them to sever fuel lines. Sadly, I hate to speak ill of any air crew that's dead, but I'm afraid they partly brought about their own deaths and killed all their passengers and wrote off the aircraft. The French flight engineer panicked. The panic was contributed to by some clown in the control tower at Charles de Gaulle, who told them that their engine was on fire, which he shouldn't have done because it wasn't. The flames you see in the infamous video are in fact the Concorde's jet exhaust igniting the fuel safely behind the aircraft, hundreds of feet behind the aircraft. No problem. This fire isn't going to catch. It's not like that silly movie. It's a great movie, but it's the scene where Bruce Willis brings down the bad guy in Die Hard 2 is a bit difficult to achieve in practice. The fire doesn't catch up to the aircraft. The aircraft's moving at 200 plus knots, and your fire is taken safely away from your aircraft because the fuel which is causing the fire, the fuel vapor, is, you know, a stream of fuel vapor that's moving behind the aircraft at 200 knots. And there was absolutely no reason to shut down any of Concorde's engines. The fire warning light came on, unsurprisingly, because there was a lot of heat behind the aircraft. The fire warning light came on, and the flight engineer panicked and shut down a perfectly good engine. From memory, he'd lost the number one engine, and he was getting intermittent power on number two. He was getting intermittent power because the fuel supply had obviously been affected by the debris from the runway. But there was no reason to shut down number two. You may come back to me and say it was number one, but there was no reason whatsoever to shut down the engine on which he had the false fire warning indication. Now, if you're a pilot or a flight engineer and you get a fire warning alarm, one of the things you do before you go shutting down the engines at a critical moment in flight is to check to make sure it's not a false alarm. The fire warning bell he got for, we'll call it number two, the fire warning bell he gets is a false indication. He should have been able to tell that by looking at his instruments. They'd have told him he actually had quite good fuel flow to that engine, and there was nothing wrong with the engine. He was getting sufficient output. His exhaust gas temperatures would have been within limits. His instruments ought to have told him that there was nothing fundamentally wrong with the engine. Indeed, there wasn't. And he shouldn't have pulled the engine. Particularly shouldn't have yanked number two, because he'd already yanked number one. He didn't have much of an option on number one because the fuel flow had been cut off number one. He was getting sufficient fuel to number two to keep her burning, and by shutting down his second engine, he was basically dooming the aircraft, because he'd shut down two engines on one side. Not only did that cut power at a critical moment in takeoff, but the flight engineer and all the flight crew would have known they were taking off overweight. So they were overweight. They were taking off in the wrong direction. So they were overweight. They were downwind. A loss of two engines was absolutely critical, particularly on the same side, because the aircraft is then asymmetric. And as you know, asymmetric aircraft, overweight, at a comparatively low airspeed, where you're not getting a lot of airflow over your rudder and your ailerons, once the flight engineer had killed his second engine, the poor old pilot really didn't have much of an option other to turn the whole ship turtle and land on the nearest restaurant. It would have been a much better idea to have kept the number two engine going instead of causing a certain crash. Keep the number two engine going in the hope that there is no fire, and it's a false indication. Keep number two going for as long as possible, and plonk your aircraft down at your nearest alternate airport, which in this case was Le Bourget. And I'm pretty confident that, and obviously I've discussed this with Concorde aircrew, pretty confident that had he only shut down one engine, although he might have had some power loss from number two, because there was an issue as to fuel supply, and we couldn't have guaranteed 100% thrust from number two, but he was getting sufficient thrust on number two to have been able to take her to Le Bourget, and ought to be able to get her down at Le Bourget without any difficulty. But the primary cause of the accident was the negligent failure to assemble the port undercarriage properly, and that was compounded by the errors of French air traffic control in sending the aircraft off in the wrong direction on the wrong runway, and the French decision to fly the aircraft overweight. And if you're taking off downwind in an overweight aircraft that's been badly maintained, which then tracks to the left-hand side of the runway and collides with the runway lights, you can't blame the people at Bristol who designed the aircraft or built her. It wasn't a problem with the aircraft. Frankly, the problem with the space of the another French mistake which compounded it was that the French had failed to put in a proper guard for tyre debris. There had been previous issues with the tyres. The Concorde was landing very fast, posing great strain on the tyres, which were made, I think, from Michelin, from memory. Some of the tyres had burst, and clearly, since the fuel tanks weren't armoured at that stage, there was always the potential for tyre debris to go into the undercarriage bay, and that's where you have your engines and your fuel lines, so it's a sensitive part of the aircraft. British Aerospace, as it had become, had sorted the problem by having a protective guard on the undercarriage leg, which would have prevented the tyre debris causing any damage. That was a perfectly satisfactory fix, but the French didn't adopt it. They had a tyre guard, but it was too weak. Probably split off under impact from tyre debris and runway debris, and caused further damage to the fuel lines. The answer there was for the French to have maintained the aircraft properly, to have complied with airworthiness recommendations that had come out of Filton, Frankly, without being unkind to the dead, bearing in mind they managed to kill all their passengers and a few people on the ground as well, instead of landing the aircraft on a restaurant, I think it would have been a better decision in all the circumstances to have landed it on a runway.
The argument was, even if the crash was due to some sort of design fault in the aircraft, that actually it wasn't commercially viable anymore.
Well, that argument was complete nonsense. I know British Airways fed it to the media. The media never asked if an airline is saying that they're not making money running aircraft, particularly a British airline. You've got to think of all the... Remember the way BOAC rubbished the Bristol Britannia? The Britannia was a very fine airliner indeed. And BOAC, for political reasons, under pressure from the Cabinet Office, hugely exaggerated the icing problem on the Bristol Proteus engine, which was actually, the fix for that was quite straightforward, not remotely justification for the whinging that BOAC put up in the 50s. Particularly when you've got a British airline on an airline as iconic as Concorde, the media should have been on the alert and should have queried British Airways when they said, we're not making money on the aircraft. Utter nonsense. The load factor on Concorde, I flew Concorde, she was my favourite aircraft. Only flew her a couple of times, but flew her before the crash and afterwards. The load factor was about 50% in the recession. To scrap the aircraft because of load factors in a recession is complete nonsense. If you're not doing well in a recession, you don't scrap your capital asset. You might need to save money in running it, but you want to look forward as a businessman to the post-recession. The load factor, even in the recession, was about 50%. The break-even factor was about 30%. Well, if there's any accountant will tell you, if your break-even factor is 30 and your load factor is 50, you're making money. So Concorde was profitable. Now, she would have made more profits as the recession ended and load factors got up to where they were. The load factors prior to the recession were pretty good on Concorde. It was a very, very popular aircraft. Certainly, I remember the first time I flew Concorde was a late booking because I was flying out of Denver and it was a Thanksgiving and we, the British Airways pilot had gone ill and the BA flight was cancelled and we all trooped over to, it's all set out in Spy Hunter, we all trooped over to New York, LaGuardia on a Frontier, on beat up Frontier Airlines 737 which had been delayed 10 hours and we all, 17 of us, trooped onto Concorde but they were the last 17 seats going and all the first and business class passengers out of Denver were upgraded onto Concorde. That was my first flight. That told me that the flight was running at about 80% load factor. The first time I flew on her, she was pretty full, and most of the Concorde passengers from that era, late 90s, early part of this century, would tell you that you wouldn't be guaranteed of getting a seat. If you left at the last minute, you wanted to get your Concorde bookings in early. The plane wasn't always full, but load factors were very good, much better than a 747 or a 777. Even in recession, 50% load factor was fine. You were making money. With the recession out of the way, the load factors were always going to go back up to 70, 80, 90%.
Ultimately, then, why was Concorde scrapped? I mean, ultimately, it's been told that this plane is a dead duck.
Well, although the plane was grounded after the Paris crash, a fix was produced. The fuel tanks were lined with Kevlar. The problem wasn't a problem anyway because a fix had already been produced in terms of the tyre guard. British Airways Concorde would not have crashed in similar circumstances, but putting aside the fact that British pilots were slightly better, the aircraft were better maintained, and airworthiness requirements were met more promptly than they were on the French kites. Putting all those factors to one side, the spare parts had all gone down to Airbus at Toulouse, and the French refused to give us the parts in complete breach of the Anglo-French Treaty. Now, that was a huge mistake. You never do a deal with the French to build an aircraft and then give them all the spare parts. You've got to hang on to your bits, because the next thing you know, the French will be refused to give them back.
So you're saying ultimately the reason why we don't have Concorde anymore is because we gave up the ability to service the plane?
Correct. We should have kept the spare parts supply operation going out of Filton. British Concordes should always have been supplied with spare parts out of Filton. The minute we let the spare parts go from Filton to Toulouse, that was the end of Concorde, because we were then effectively allowing the French to dictate whether we could fly our aircraft. And we must always remember that the French contribution to Concorde was pretty minimal. It was basically consisted of the E on the spelling. The SNECMA did a little bit on the engines, but the engines were Bristol Olympus. We didn't actually need the French. It was a political decision it increased the cost of the aircraft. It would be much better to have let Bristol design the aircraft from the word go. There was no important French technological contribution to Concorde. She was a British idea. The engines are British. The Ogilvy wing was British in concept. And the fly-by-wire, the revolutionary fly-by-wire control system, was all British. The only things that the French contributed to Concorde were the spelling and the champagne. Everything else done at Toulouse we could have done ourselves, and frankly much cheaper. Without the French holding us back, I'm confident we could have got Concorde into the air by 69, certainly comfortably in advance of the German decision to jack up fuel prices and organise the oil price shock of 73. I think, left to Bristol, I think we could have got the aircraft into service 69-70.
But the question is why?
Well, it was political. The French, you know, they're a bit chauvinistic, no offence intended. The French couldn't bear the thought of British Airways flying Concordes when Air France couldn't. Once Air France had decided to take the aircraft out of service, as far as the French were concerned, the British Concordes had to come out of service by hook or by crook. And if that meant breaching a treaty, then they broke the treaty. There's absolutely no point. One of the lessons of Concorde is there was no point ever signing a treaty with the French.
That was Michael Shrimpton, QC. Next week we'll be back. This programme is online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. You can follow my Twitter feed at Tony Gosling. We'll be back next week.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a Pakistani schoolgirl who was shot in the head by the Taliban 3 months ago has been discharged from hospital in Birmingham. Malala, who's 15, was able to walk out of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. She was